Hey there, you're listening to 101.5 FM on UMFM. I'm your host, Ryan Funk, and welcome to UTalk. Happy Tuesday. I hope all of you are doing well. Since February is the shortest month of the year, I thought I would extend Black History Month for a bit longer, with two great interviews today. One with a Comey, the other, Dr. Jared Bullard. Let's get into it. ACOMI, the African Communities of Manitoba Inc., is uniting the Winnipeg community through unity, friendship of people of African heritage in Manitoba, and creating understanding between peoples of African heritage and Canadians of all backgrounds. With it being Black History Month, I wanted to connect with ACOMI to learn about the organization and some of its programs coming in the future.
Hi, my name is Tololi Lilaboye. I am the Director of Operations with the African Communities of Manitoba, or as we, I suppose, more commonly are known as ACOMI. I have been with the organization for about 9 or 10 years now. I actually just recently stepped down from the board to take on this role to really try to kind of bolster the work that we've been doing and bring us up to full speed to say, let's move into the future at full steam. And so that's kind of where I'm at right now and who I am.
What is ACOMI? Is that how you say the acronym properly?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So what is the organization?
ACOMI is an organization that kind of focuses, that I shouldn't say kind of, but ACOMI is an organization that focuses in on providing culturally relevant supports to people of African descent in Manitoba, while also looking at how can we advocate for people who identify as Black, African, Caribbean, person of African descent to ensure that they can find a safe sense of safety and belonging in the province. And so we do things from advocacy to governance models and support to other affiliate organizations, again, of which we have 42 with the organization registered. And then we also do provide free tax clinics, for example. A large portion of our participants at our resource center that we run in downtown Winnipeg actually engages a large population of Indigenous folks as well, and the broader population. Our women's program is for all women, despite where you come from. And so with that program, we actually had quite a few women from East Asia. And so although we do identify as a Black-led, Black-owned organization, or a 3B organization as a popular term right now, we don't restrict our programming to people of African descent. We really do try to make sure that we are building inclusivity in our province and building cultural relevancy and supports through diversifying our program to include everybody.
Yeah, just being a part of a community, regardless yeah. of like someone's backgrounds. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I have a little bit of a goldfish brain in terms of when people start saying numbers, but you mentioned there was 43 different communities that make part of this organization.
Yeah, so we have 42 different affiliate organizations who are registered with ACOMI at this time. And that number fluctuates obviously year to year, but those organizations are made up of smaller cultural groups. So whether it be the Sierra Leone group, or there's maybe 4 or 5 different Nigerian groups, but they all kind of represent different communities within the Nigerian context. We have Ghana Union, we have Congo, but we also on top of that have Black-led, Black-owned organizations like the African Movie Film Festival and Africana, who are members of the organization. So those organizations also do their own programming and things like that as well. And they're not just focused on one cultural group. So those 42 members make up everything that ACOMI is, and that's how we function as an umbrella organization. But we, you know, we rely on the support and community development of these individual groups to be able to do the work that we do. So we really are kind of looking at ACOMI as a community organization that works with community organizations to do the work that we see on the ground.
Yeah, so sort of a bridge or a hub between all of these different organizations and communities.
Yeah, exactly. We really try to pull, you know, in 2020, we were one of the forerunners in creating the Black Community Collective, for example. So ACOMI kind of stands as one of the larger Black organizations, Black serving organizations in the province, and one of the more established ones, particularly on the African side. And so we, in 2020, we, after the murder of George Floyd, we decided to bring together all the Black serving organizations across the city of Winnipeg predominantly to kind of come together as a single Black community collective to talk about some some of the issues that we've been seeing and to collectively respond to what we had seen with the Black Lives Matter protests and what we were seeing against, you know, anti-Black racism in our province. And so work like that is kind of what founds Ocomee as a pillar of this community and being able to really bring our community together and also create opportunities for individuals and families and children and youth in our communities as well.
When we're seeing like issues of like the death of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter movement, a lot of that focuses on, you know, the states. What is that kind of relationship here in Manitoba for the Black community?
I think it's actually a really challenging misconception to think that racism like that only happens in the states. You know, shortly before George Floyd was murdered in the states, we had the murder of a Black man by police officers in Manitoba, right? So when you think about the situation, we think about the states, we think about, you know, the political movements of America, the civil rights movements in America, but the fact of the matter is that stuff happens in Canada. But as we've seen with many protests, many movements across this country, it's difficult in Canada, I think, to get a national movement going because we are so large. And I think Canada splits itself very distinctly into three major groups, and even within those groups there's smaller groups, notwithstanding the trucker protests, which I won't necessarily say my true honest feelings about.
That's a can of worms we don't need to open up right now.
But I think, you know, people often think, oh, well, it's not like that in Canada. But I think about the fact that I tell the story often, but I went out to Pinawa and I was just there with a group of friends. There was all women of color, mostly Black. And there was a guy there wearing a Confederate flag hat. You know, that I've had instances of, I was coming out of church one day and some two guys in Windsor Park drove past us screaming niggers, right? Like that kind of stuff happens in Canada all the time. And to I guess minimize the fact that doesn't happen, maybe we don't see it. Because I mean, a lot of our news comes from the States. We don't really talk about some of these things in the same way in Canada, because we really do promote our multiculturalism and diversity, which is really important. But also that can't overshadow the fact that these things are still happening. There's a reason why there was an anti-Asian hate movement. There was a reason why there's Black Lives Matter movements happening here in the province, happening here in this country, because these things happen and we hear these stories all the time. People come to Canada, they just want to get a job and they can't even get a job. And so it's not even just at the community level, it's in employment, it's in education. There's a project we're actually working on right now called the Then and Now Project, which paints a picture of the history of Black community organizing in our province. And it's interesting because during the 60s and 70s, there was a large contingency of immigration from the Caribbean predominantly. And during that time, the folks who had come over from the Caribbean, they actually amassed themselves to organize as Black organizers, to actually infiltrate these different political groups and become leaders of these political groups so that we could actually have Black voices in there, because they were having to fight against, you know, their kids being in ESL classes when, you know, in Jamaica and Trinidad, English is the first language. But they were being told that they have to go to ESL, even though they speak English fluently, right? So this form of racism, the systemic racism that we see, is everywhere across this country. I mean, again, coming back to the trucker protests, you can't tell me that wasn't racially charged, first and foremost. But also, when you think about the comparisons and how that was dealt with, how much discrimination was inherently built into the response to that protest, and these ways we think about racism and against multiculturalism in Canada, it fundamentally needs to change, because we see stuff like that happening here all the time.
Well, I think it just really shows the systemic issues within our systems when you see this trucker protest and people in power just kind of letting it happen, even though, you know, they're symbols of hate being flown over these trucks, and like swastikas drawn directly on the Canadian flag, whereas you see like indigenous protests where they're protecting their lands from pipelines, or like homeless people, they're like shuttled away when they're just trying to, you know, find a place warm. Like there's definitely a disconnect between how our authorities treat different people.
Well, I mean, you know, I think about the protests that were happening across Eastern Canada, the Indigenous protests happening across Eastern Canada that were violently dealt with And I think about even in Winnipeg during the Black Lives Matter protests, some of the posters that were going up saying that there would be bombings and shootings and everyone should protect themselves. And from my understanding, this was coming out of the, you know, authoritative bodies saying that this is what this is going to be like. Cut to scene. And you have 4 or 5 streets blocked off by trucks. And we're now all of a sudden removing mandates. And I know they say that it's not whatever or whatever, but like, you know, the difference is tangible. It's palatable. You could paint a picture, and to highlight that is a critical, I think, at this time, because we can say that, hey, in Canada, this happens too. In Manitoba, this happens too. And this is the reality of what we experience. And I think, you know, one of the things that I personally am really focused in on is also understanding that you don't have to be a newcomer or an immigrant to experience that as a Black person, as a person of color, as a person of the global majority, right? However you want to define that. But I was born and raised in Winnipeg. My whole life, all I know is this city. And I experience racism all the time. I live the street from a house that has this very, to me, a very racial piece of art on there, or art piece, I guess you can call it, a structure, a sculpture on their front lawn, which is this little Black boy with very big red pink lips with a wide brim hat fishing off the side of their step. That's a racially charged image to me. And to live, walk past there every single day, to drive past there every day, or however many times I leave the house, that's racism. That's fundamentally racism to me. And so this is happening everywhere across. And it sometimes feels like it's the boldness of those who are racist, oppressive, discriminatory, however you want to define it, they're becoming more bold. And in that boldness, there's more grace given to them from the people who are supposed to be shutting this down.
Yeah, you're right. We should be hearing more of these stories in our Canadian media. It's definitely something that is kind of glossed over a little bit. For information months like Black History Month, do you think this can help inform the public about some of these issues that Black Canadians are facing, and kind of give awareness for them to maybe empathize better with, you know, the experiences Black Canadians have gone through?
I think what's really beautiful about Black History Month, I mean, Manitoba, we have Black History Month Manitoba, who works on building knowledge and experience around what's going on in our Black communities from the historical aspect, but also right now where people can get engaged. And I think there's a lot of power in that, to be able to say, you know, this month is dedicated to this group, to us, to say, come and engage with us, come and learn about the culture, so come and understand what's going on. So that I think there's a lot of power in that. I think there's a lot of opportunity in that space. I do think that we could look at Black History Month not only as a single month and like really build it into our education and build it across the year, right? You know, I think about Indigenous Peoples Day as about, like, you get a single day for people that have been here there forever, right? Yeah. So I think that there, Black History Month definitely gives opportunity to highlight what's happening. But I also think about movements like the United Nations Declaration for People of African Descent, which ends in 2024. And how can we highlight that ongoing throughout the year to be able to say, let's talk about these issues, but also let's talk about how we can all connect? Because it's not necessarily just about empathizing, it's also about actioning that. I think that a lot of the work has historically been placed on the people who've been historically oppressed. And so it's time for the people who have been the oppressors to deliberately and intentionally and fully engage with these movements, to fully engage with even just something as little as come and volunteer, donate $5 monthly, right, to a Black-led organization, buy Black, like go and find, there's Black-owned Manitoba, you can check out Black businesses, go and support these organizations, fund and support these communities that have been historically disadvantaged.
You're 100% right. We need to kind of change our lens and focus to incorporate, you know, minority communities into the mainstream and into the mindset year round, whether it's like a Pride, like Asian Heritage Month, whatever organization or denomination or group that kind of has this one month where it's focused, like we need to tie that into just society. Like we're just so concerned about, like in the West, it's like whiteness and like being cis or straight is kind of like the standard overview, but that needs to shift.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
There are some really cool things happening at Acomi. What are some of the programs that are coming up? And I know you they recently hired a new director of community programs.
We're really excited. We've seen so much growth. It's been really exponential. And so kind of coming back to what I just said, after 2020, we've really seen a huge influx of support. So I'm not saying everything that I said previously, it's not to say that we haven't seen support come through and people really step up and stand up with us. We've seen, for example, the Black Community Collective transitioned into helping to form the Police Accountability Coalition, for example. So a lot of really cool new partnerships in there. We hired a new director of programs to help grow our programming, to increase our outreach. Because of that, we were able to start our seniors program, which is amazing. We've had a lot of African seniors say that, where do we go? So all the aunties and uncles, they're coming. We take them to games, you know, hockey games, football games. We go out and do activities, which has been really great. We also have an upcoming free tax clinic, which we're really excited about. So if you want to get your taxes done for free, you can come down to the Acomi Resource Center. We're also launching a new project right now that we're so pumped about. It's called the Then and Out Project. And it basically paints a picture of Black community organizing in this province from the individual level all the way to some of the biggest level, you know, anti-apartheid movements, Black Lives Matters protest, all of these different major movements that we've seen in the past. So that project, I'm really pumped about it. It's going to be a digital library of content and history in this province. So we are constantly evolving with what's going on, with what the community needs. From, you know, our women's program, we're transitioning our youth program, making it bigger. We partnered with Royal Bank of Canada to offer larger scholarships to Black Manitobans, Black Manitoban youth particularly. So I can't even go through the whole list, because it's constantly changing. Hiring a director of community programs really allowed us to be able to upscale a lot of the work that we're doing, provide more services, but you know, we can always continue to use that support. We can always continue to use the financial support, the physical support. So we always encourage anybody and everybody to come on down and hang out.
That's a lot of stuff, and it sounds really cool. I'm really excited to see how everything kind of like comes together in the coming months.
Totally, I'm so pumped for the summer. I think it'll be good. I also am hoping and thinking that Folklorama will be back, which means that we'll get the Africa Pavilion back on track. So that's one of the largest pavilions. I mean, it hosts every country from Africa. So it's not just one country. It's literally the entire continent of Africa. So hopefully Folklorama pops off again this summer. We'll have another festival. Hopefully all of our performers have been working hard to change up their dance.
Yeah, I know there's a little hesitation when we're hearing the announcements from the government about like restrictions like ending so quickly, but there's also like that feeling inside me that I'm kind of a little excited to see how things happen. And you know, if we can finally get to kind of a normal normancy that...
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, being able to reconnect with people without the idea of being like, are we allowed to be here? I think it'll be really good. I think it'll relieve a lot of people, remembering all the people who may not be as open to this, but I think that there's good and bad in everything, right? And so I'm looking forward to hopefully maybe having another Folklorama this year, even if it's a smaller scale, because the Africa Pavilion is part of our community advocacy. It's part of our community building. Saturday night, we don't have an after party, but Saturday night, everyone stays and cleans up, and it is the best party. Your DJ is amazing. And he plays music and we just clean, and it's the best part of my entire summer usually. So I hope to see something like that again.
Yeah, kind of going out and seeing people's faces is going to be exciting, and being able to like share food, and it's something that has been dearly missed.
I think so too. And you know, when you talk about food, African communities and food, it's the way that we connect. You know, you go to an auntie's house or whatever, and they're going to offer you peanuts and a Coca-Cola and a full pound of yam meal and just everything on the table, right? So you're not going home empty-handed, and you're not going to come and sit hungry, right? So being able to connect around just sharing community again will be really wonderful.
Where can people go to if they want to join Acomi? And where can they find more information?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely take a look at our website, www.acomi.ca. We also have Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. Our YouTube page is lacking, but it is there. and our website's actually under construction, but feel free. You can also reach out to us, info@acomi.ca. Pretty easy. Acomi, A-C-O-M-I. So reach out to us, connect with us. We're also doing this month for every single person who connects with us during Black History Month. You have the opportunity to view a film called Beyond Kinks and Curls, and you also get free hair product for kinky and coily hair for courtesy of Lush Cosmetics. So that's a huge boon. Connect with us this month and you get free hair product. I mean, that's a win.
That's a win-win for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. So connect with us, reach out. We'd love to hear from you.
What does it take to become a doctor? Of course, there's the years of diligent study, but also a drive to understand what ails people, and a passion to heal the wounded. Dr. Jared Bullard exemplifies those traits. Not only is he a pediatric infectious disease expert, but he is driven to inspire the doctors of tomorrow.
So my name is Jared Bullard. I'm one of the physicians who works here in Winnipeg. I am a pediatric infectious disease doctor and section head of that particular program. And I'm also a medical microbiologist. And so I'm associate medical director at CADM Provincial Lab, the public health lab for Manitoba. So a lot of the COVID testing has been done here.
What first attracted you to working in medicine?
If you were to ask my parents, I was interested in medicine from a pretty early age, like about when I was 11. I don't know anything in particular that did it. I certainly think of my grandma was sick around the time, and I remember thinking I wanted to help her, and then revisited that back in high school as well. And it was neat there too, because at that point I was thinking along the lines of psychiatry. I have no idea what particularly or why I would consider that. But then it was once I was in undergraduate Bachelor of Science, it's where I started to do a lot more work in microbiology and parasitology. And I really thought that was the way to go. Just because I found it super intriguing and I thought that maybe that's what I wanted to end up doing. But then, of course, as you progress and you get into medical school, you start seeing certain aspects of medicine that appeal to you. And again, I found that anything related to infectious diseases and microbiology was, in fact, really appealing. What helped, too, is that I actually had a year off between medical school and finishing my undergraduate degree. And it was at that point that I started doing some research with the HIV researchers here at the University of Manitoba. And I found, again, that just reinforced. So there was all this reinforcement basically throughout undergrad, the research, and then medical school, which ultimately led me to do the various disciplines that I currently do.
I have a friend who's currently studying the sciences in microbiology. And what he tells me, it's pretty intensive stuff sometimes.
It can be. It can be very complicated. And it's interesting now that we're in COVID times that people are using phrases that you would never have expected them to do. And there's a lot of interest just in what we do and how we think. And it's really cool.
When you're going through school and you're going through these different elements, were you like surprised when you got attracted into microbiology? And what was that like class structure like? Were there times where you feel like you were just hitting your head against the wall?
No, I'd say that, you know what, going through undergrad, I always knew that I liked microbiology, and microbiology is broken up into all sorts of different components. So bacteriology is something that I did a fair amount in my undergraduate days, and parasitology, I loved the course so much that I actually became the lab demonstrator at the University of Winnipeg for both parasitology and bacteriology. I'd say the biggest surprise to me, if anything, was that when I was doing medical school, I knew I wanted to do infectious disease and potentially microbiology as well. But I always was under the impression I would end up being in internal medicine, which deals with adults and older patients. And if you would have asked me my first year if I'd end up going into pediatrics, there's no way that would have happened. But all it took was a rotation in internal medicine as a clerk to make me go, I don't know if this is the right fit. But when I did pediatrics, I saw the light, I think is what some people said. That I applied to that program in addition to internal medicine. And in the end, it worked out quite well. I'm very, very happy doing pediatric infectious diseases. And I think more so than I would have been doing internal medicine adult infectious diseases.
What was it about just that kind of...
You know, the biggest thing, and I tell trainees who about this experience, was that you're there for about 7 weeks doing a rotation, and you get to know these people, and they're fantastic, and you really enjoy your time with them, and it's almost like you're polishing them up, and you get them to a point where they can go home, and you're all excited, and then toward the end of that 7 weeks, there's a whole bunch of them coming back, and you're just like, what's going on here? And then on top of that, I found that even like a month or two after I finished the rotation, a lot of them were showing up in the obituaries. And I found that not hard, but it was just, you know, it was a lot of work to get people to come to a plan to make them feel better and get them home. And ultimately, I almost felt it was futile. And not to say that it was, that was just my perception of it, because I know that there's lots of doctors who do internal medicine, including my wife, who love that sort of thing and trying to optimize kind of more of end-of-life care. When I did pediatrics, it was the opposite. It was as complicated as internal medicine, but once they got home, they stayed home. They didn't come back, and it was really gratifying to see that. And I think that the culture in pediatrics is a bit more of a better fit for me as well. They're a little bit more laid back in some ways, and a bit more fun. Not that, again, other doctors aren't fun, but pediatricians are a special group when it comes down to it.
Yeah, you mentioned that your wife was also a doctor. What is the home life like with two doctors kind of thing? Do you like share stories? You're like, oh, I was trying to figure this thing out.
So you're right. Dinner and casual conversation often goes back to medicine and talking about it. And our children, I get to hear it all the time too, and they're used to it. And they've actually picked up an interesting skill and knowledge set at this point. They can talk about it too. But you know what? It's great that you have someone that you can share that with. And I think that's one of the things that's made being in medicine a little bit easier too, because the both of us are both academic physicians and quite specialized. And so it's great to have that that camaraderie in addition to everything else you get from this book.
I went to the University of Manitoba's website, and then there was a link there to all the different studies and like articles that you've worked on. I think it was something like 41 results were in there. Just what is the experience like working on these articles and papers, and which one kind of stands out to you as the one that you're most proud of?
If you would have asked me 3-4 years ago if I was a researcher, I probably would have said not really. A lot of what I focused on in doing research was really answering straightforward questions, which I guess is research, but it was more to do with how do we provide better services in terms of testing and screening, and especially around the sexually transmitted bloodborne infections and HIV. So that was kind of what I started. But with COVID, it really came down to being at the right place, right time with a very specific knowledge and skill set to be able to answer certain questions. So when I think of the research and the papers that have come out, the two that I'm particularly proud of would be one that was in the Clinical Infectious Diseases in May of 2020, predicting SARS coronavirus 2 infectivity from patient samples, and why that one in particular. So this was actually one of the first research studies in the world that defined exactly how long somebody with COVID was infectious. And that's where we discovered that it was probably in that 8 to 10 day range. And why I'm particularly proud of that paper as well is, I mean, the people that I worked with here in Manitoba, it was not just at CADM Lab, it was the University of Manitoba people, it was people in public health, it was people over at the National Lab. And we basically defined the way to do the particular studies that we did, looking at this particular virus, linking it to clinical and epidemiological data, and then also defining the cell culture way to do it. And then so when I hear people using the word cycle threshold or CT values, and you can see that it's actually become part of common lingo in and around COVID, it's interesting that I had a contribution to that particular research. The other one that comes to mind that I'm particularly proud of is within the Canadian Medical Association Journal last year in April. And so that one was following up on the initial study, because we wanted to make sure that we included children. As a pediatrician, we know that kids are not always the same as adults, and they have different ways that they interact with the world and the world interacts with them. And we thought that maybe SARS coronavirus 2 was going to be a little bit different. And all we were looking to do was actually just define, well, how long are they infectious? We knew that it was 8 days for adults, but we didn't have any children in that initial study. And so we tried to do that, and we didn't actually manage to achieve that goal. But what we did demonstrate was that children consistently had less virus when compared to adults, and the amount of virus that we could grow, implying that it was live, viable, able to cause infection, was significantly less. And that was really interesting to us, but it also kind of made sense, because at this point we were starting to see that clinically, children weren't getting as sick. They really, fortunately, don't really seem to be impacted by COVID to the same degree as adults. And then on top of it, they weren't spreading it nearly as well, because that's very, very different than influenza, RSV, or any number of different viruses that affect children. They spread it very well. In fact, we look to them to know when we're going to be hit with respiratory virus season. Once we see it in kids, we know that in about 2 to 4 weeks, we're going to see it in the adult population. So I would say that those two in particular were highlights, because they were just the impact that they had, and the interest in the general population was also just inspiring, just to say, wow, people are actually interested in science.
Yeah, when you're talking about like influenza and things like that with young kids, I think it was, I guess, 3 years ago now, like out in the there was a school, and basically the whole school got sick almost instantly all at once. Like everyone, all the students were out, and it's like, wow. Yeah, when kids get sick, like everyone gets sick. So I think that's just very interesting how like COVID-19 just hasn't really been that kind of same development that like influenza or things are.
Right. And I think that's really an important message that to help public health people and clinicians and the general population appreciate that. I mean, it's not the same in children. If it were, and it can become, I mean, the variants certainly can modify themselves to be more infectious, and maybe we'll find that it changes in children over time. But right now, including with Omicron, it's still not doing the same things that it's doing in adults. So that's good. That's a good mm-hmm. thing. Right.
For someone who spent like so much time, like as a researcher, diligently working through these studies and creating these papers, how frustrating must it be when people just come in with like, oh, I know all of this now because of just a quick Google search. I know all these things.
Yeah. Yeah, that's been the past 2 years. Right. And it's to be expected. I think that you can't have something as dominant in society and culture as COVID has been without expecting people to want to learn more about it. And that's great. Again, it's just people being curious and wanting to understand. But yeah, it is a bit frustrating when they start telling me about, in particular, I've actually had people question what my research means. And you're like, well, that's not what it means at all. I mean, I'm pretty comfortable with the interpretations you made. But it's, you know, it's a combination of the lay public certainly has taken my research and their understanding of COVID, and it's not quite accurate. That also applies to some other physicians and practitioners too, right? Like it's being an infectious disease and a medical microbiologist is pretty specialized. And so it's hard, especially for doctors or in other areas to truly appreciate kind of what's needed to properly interpret those. And that's fair. You know, I mean, we all have patients and everybody's best interest in mind, and I keep that in the back of my head. But yeah, it's been an interesting road, and I love when people throw out phrases and terms and you're like, wow, this is exciting. And then, you know, it's good. I mean, only good can come from having people show more interest in our field of interest.
The internet is such a great tool, but it's also a dangerous tool sometimes, as you know, we've seen through this whole pandemic, how just an image with some text on it can influence someone's entire opinion.
Oh, correct. Yeah, it's true. It, the internet is a great place, but I mean, there's information overload as well. And how do you know what is reliable information versus misinformation versus disinformation? And I think that's part of our job as physicians and doctors to provide everybody with the best information that you can, so they can make the best choices. And that's inherent in being a doctor. We do that all the time, and that's beyond COVID.
It can be 100% understandable how some people don't want to sit down and sift through a research paper. They can be incredibly daunting. So I mean, maybe that's like a shift in society where we need to like make papers or studies more accessible, more understandable to people. But I mean, that's a whole other can of worms.
That's an entirely separate conversation for sure.
As a person of color, have you faced any challenges while working within just the medical fields or STEM? Because I've had conversations, immigrant and international women in science, they're a group that works to get particularly immigrant women into the fields that they study, because you know, they're having a hard time finding jobs, or when they do, there's a lot of discrimination in there.
You know what? I mean, I'm originally from the Bahamas and I was born there, but moved here when I was fairly young to Winnipeg. What I noticed more than anything, being Black or biracial technically, is that it was very rare to have another Black person in my class or program. Like I can literally think in kindergarten through grade 9, there was one other Black girl. In high school, in the honors program, there was one other Black guy. When I did my Bachelor of Science at the University of Winnipeg, there was one guy in chemistry and me in biochemistry, molecular biology. And then in medical school, there in a cohort of 300 of us, there were literally two Black people, me and a good friend of mine in my wife's year, actually. And that was really interesting. It was just that feeling that, you know, there really wasn't the best representation of Black people in general. And certainly, knowing that I was a 15th graduate from the University of Manitoba's medical school in its entire history was interesting too, right? In terms of the practice of medicine, it's not often that being Black comes up. I would say more than anything, it's related, or more as a person of color, is that people ask where I'm from. And I don't take it personally. I really just kind of think it's interesting. And sometimes I will play with them and I'll mention, like, I'll joke that, oh, it's my accent. And that's what you're picking up on. And of course I have a, you know, St. Patel Winnipeg accent, but they go, yeah, it's your accent. I was like, yeah, okay, sure. But a lot of the time I'm just explaining that, yeah, no, I'm from the Bahamas originally. And it's not just, I would say, white people. It's more common, I'd say, from white parents, grandparents, and patients. But I also get that from a variety of different other people of color. So Indians often think I'm Indian. Filipinos have mistaken me for Filipino. So you know what? I think it's just trying to find common ground more often than not. And it's not in an insulting way that I'm asked usually. It is just kind of curiosity, because I think that African patients or Black patients are genuinely interested to know when I'm from. I tell them I'm from the Bahamas and the West Indies. They think that's great. The other cool thing that I think happens a lot too is that there aren't a lot of Black physicians that children would see. And so again, it's that representation aspect, that having a Black child see a Black physician come into the room, and you can always see that they get very excited about it. They're like, whoa, you know. And I do talk to them all the time, and I ask them what they want to do. And some of them want to be doctors, and it's something that I encourage. I say, you know what, you stay in school and you work really hard, and I'm going to see you when you're here and you're graduating to be a doctor. I'll be right front row for you. And I hope that message sticks. And that,
well, of course, you want that diversity in the medical field. Like, maybe it can just help someone feel more comfortable if there's someone who looks like them in there, or just the diversity of opinions or thoughts on tackling a certain situation. Everyone has different backgrounds and experiences. So, like, having that just melting pot of more ideas is only beneficial.
I think there's many ways to come at any particular problem, and having that diversity is really important. I mean, certainly as a working in a public health lab, I mean, I look at all sorts of issues that we have traditional methods to address, and it doesn't work. And then you suddenly engage any number of different community grassroots movements from different cultures, and they have these ideas. There's like, well, that's great. That's actually really smart. And then you incorporate it, and you start to see some movement of the needle, and it's actually very reassuring, right? It's great to see that diversity. And that's something, again, that's important. I mean, having that diversity represented in your medical school to reflect the population that you serve is key. And that's one of the goals that I have as a Black physician. In particular, I'm also part of the Black Physicians of Canada as a Central Canada representative. And that's one of the many, many things that we're advocating and looking to enhance, really, to make sure that we have representation at the various universities across the country.
Awesome. So yeah, just getting involved. What do you think are some other ways that we can just help make just medicine and the fields of STEM more inclusive and inviting to diversity?
I think the key is catching people when they're young, right? It's if you can plant that seed in their head that you are good at this and you belong here, just like anybody else, that would go a long way, right? And that's why I make a point of pointing or saying that to the patients that I see, who, and it's not just Black patients, Indigenous patients, Filipino, any of them, really, I will just say, you know what, like, this is important. And I think that's the most important message, is just that you belong here, that science is for you. Like, if you have an ability to think problems through and you like figuring stuff out, you know what? Again, sciences is a great opportunity to make that happen.
You seem like an awesome guy, and I really hope that message is ingrained in these kids. And, you know, maybe in the next couple decades, we're starting to see a much more vast group of people working in medicine. I think it'd be so cool to see, like, doctors of, like, all backgrounds just walking around, figuring out solutions, helping patients.
And I agree. And then right now, even, you know what, I can see the change. I've been in medicine for just over 20 years now, and I think of what it was like when I first started to what it is now, and you can see that diversity happening. Young people in particular, the millennials, we bash on them all the time, but they bring a whole different perspective, and they're very inclusive, and it's really going to be cool to see where we go in the next 20 years.
Well, it was great talking with you. Where can people go to find some of those studies that you've worked on?
Boy, you know what? Most of the time, it's a simple one, Google Scholar. If you're to go and put my name, Jared Bullard, into it, you'll find pretty much every study that I've done. And it's usually accessible to most people that way. So that would be my suggestion. Most of the papers and research that I've done will show up there.
And I guess just one final thing, if you were going to tackle another study or research paper, what is that dream project that you'd like to work on?
Oh, that is a fantastic question. You know, one of the things that I'm really looking at and I've always been interested in is HIV and STDIs. And in particular here in Manitoba with our problems with syphilis, there's a lot of syphilis going on, way more than there should be. And as a result, you're seeing a lot of kids born with syphilis, which is something that really shouldn't happen. And so I think that a lot of my research and you stay tuned, you'll see a lot of the products of those research coming out. And it's looking at it from a very broad base to help clinicians figure out how to diagnose it, help public health know how to properly define it so they can get resourced appropriately. And so all of those things are coming. And I think that it'd be really great if I could do the same for HIV, which I think is coming too. I'll work on that after, you know, COVID's in the backseat for a little while anyway.
I'm Ryan Funk. This was You Talk. And have yourself a good one.
You know.